Campus FM presents the second part of an international seminar organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies, entitled Captivating the Real in Narrative Research.
This is our second MA Youth and Community Studies cohort that are doing the presentation. That is Clive Bonici, Sarah Gallia, Richard Gourmi, and Marvic De Bono. So I think it's been very courageous of them to take on board this task when they have so much to do with their course at this point in time. So I leave it to them because I'm sure we're going to have a very interesting presentation.
My life, such a lonely day, should be banned. It's a day that I can't stand. The most loneliest day of my life.
It's a lonely word. My story. Loneliness as a topic evokes several questions. How many lonely people can we identify? Where do you find lonely people? Why are they lonely? What are the characteristics of a lonely person? What is being done for lonely persons? What benefits do lonely people get from institutions? This short presentation is an example on how a narrative account is presented. This data is aimed at supplying the researcher with information through the use of qualitative data. John's story can answer these questions. Whilst looking for the address, we noticed a small group of young people huddled outside the door. We guessed that they were the young people we wanted to talk to. We watched them from across the road and noticed that they did not engage in much conversation together, and that there was a lot of awkward silence between the rare flow of conversation. They were relieved to see the two friendly volunteers finally arrived. This could be because it was cold outside, or because maybe they were looking forward to the once weekly session. We sat inside a cold room, with chairs neatly placed in a semicircle. Some of the young people sat alone, whilst others sat together. They looked at us, quietly, but no smile was forthcoming. The volunteers asked how they were, and some looked down in embarrassment. I'm okay, nothing special, were their monosyllable, barely audible answers. We, the interviewers, introduced ourselves, and got a mixed reaction, with some friendly replies, and some uncomfortable nods. The room went very silent again, and it was us who broke the silence with a joke about football, even though the volunteers and we, the interviewers, were the only ones laughing. There was a very apparent difficulty to communicate back, and the conversation was very much one-sided. It was as if the people of this group had never met each other before, although we later confirmed that most of the members were in fact frequent attendees of this club. We asked for two volunteers, and that's how we met John. John, a tall 28-year-old man, tended to walk and sit hunched over, his slouched back betraying the real height of this young man. His body seemed to have assumed the position of looking down, and although we spent an hour with him, it was hard to really notice the shape and color of his eyes, since he insisted on looking down a lot, and his spectacles were truly and honestly as thick as the bottom of a bottle, making his eyes seem the size of peas. One could not describe him as ugly, but the manner in which he came across, with his loud slurred voice and his nervous tics and mannerism, may put some people off. However, the truth is, he was nervous. He showed it and admitted it. Although he had volunteered to be interviewed and recorded, it was only later on in the interview that we realized that he didn't want the audio tape on. "That's better," he said, the minute we switched the tape off. John switched on and opened up about his life. The little flick sound of switching off the dictaphone was enough for John to disclose himself. So who is John, we asked? And how does he spend his day? This is his story. My name is John. I am single. I am single and don't have a partner. I have nobody. I am also unemployed and have never had a proper job. I live with my mom and dad, and I am an only child. There's nothing much more to say. I'm unemployed. I would like to attend computer classes, but I can't because I don't have the money because I'm unemployed. I register unemployed with ETC. They know I want to become a storekeeper just like my dad was. I want this job because it's a responsible job and I get to meet other people. I don't want to work outside, and this type of job would be good for me. At this point in time, John proudly presents two pieces of jewelry from his pocket, which is his own filigree work. A very pretty cross and a heart pendant. We wondered why he carried them around with him. It was hard to believe that this young man, with trembling hands, such thick glasses, and who seemed so on edge, could make such pretty items that required so much patience and precision. Every day I spend time on my hobby, which is filigree. It involves a lot of patience, and not everyone can do it. You need a lot of patience. This work is unique because it is made by hand. It brings out my creative skills and requires a lot of time and effort. Therefore, it isn't really worth doing as full-time employment. I don't think they are perfect anyway, like what the machines produce. But then again, how can they be if they are made by hand? People want to buy perfect things these days. Thinking about it, the filigree story is my own story. How can I expect to be accepted by others when I am not perfect? Who would buy such an article like me? I like using my computer and try my best to practice some of the functions. I do this every day. I don't have internet access because I am unemployed and I cannot afford it. A thought crossed our minds. If John had internet access, then maybe his situation could be different. He could chat as well as read and possibly get job opportunities over the net. I like to watch TV, and my favorite channel is Channel 22, because it gives information about courses I attend. In fact, I got to know about this club through Channel 22. My typical day is wake up in the morning, eat my breakfast, shower, and watch some Channel 22. Then I do my filigree to do something different. I eat lunch and practice my computer skills. In the evening, I listen to some music with my dad. I look forward to it, as for me, this is the highlight of my day. My dad and I like to listen to the 80s music. I like classical music as well. Music is the medium which gets me closer to my father. My dad is company for me, because I don't go out. I don't have any friends to go out with. My father means the world to me. People don't like my company, especially girls. I don't know why. A girl I knew once didn't want a relationship with me, and another just got fed up after a while. Maybe it's because I don't have a job or any money. I don't have such a problem with male friends, but I still don't have any male friends either. Although I feel at ease when talking to male friends, I still never manage to make lasting relationships. I feel good about coming to this group once a week. The people here are on the same level as me. I felt worse about myself before attending this group, but now I feel better. The group meets once a week every Friday. We never meet together any other day, although sometimes we go out for a drink after the club. The other members seem unsociable. Some people don't respect or appreciate me. My aunt, who is a manager, tells me that I'm a bit slow, and we have nothing in common, and that's why she doesn't pay much attention to me. I'm not of the same class as she is, since she's more educated. Some people with higher education have a higher social status, and I feel they don't want to mix with me, you know what I mean? This is really not fair. I feel that I am being punished for no particular reason. Loneliness is a form of social and emotional punishment. Human beings are gregarious animals, but I am living as a hermit in a solitary confinement. On the other hand, foreigners are different. English, Germans, and sometimes American, who I meet at prayer meetings I attend, are very friendly. I am a friendly person and would talk to everyone, even the dustbin man. John is putting himself higher in status and identifying himself below the academic, but above the unskilled worker. I think my problem is how I approach people. I push them away, and I don't know exactly why. I think I'm nervous, but I don't want to take pills, because they will make me worse. I go walking every day. It helps me keep calm. I walk alone. I had a happy childhood, but I was bullied. The bullies would threaten me, take my money, and tell me that they would beat me up if I told my mom. Many a times I would return home to go to my tomb-like room and cry for hours. During those moments, I felt I had no one to turn to. I remember myself trying to slash my wrist and try to inflict pain upon myself. I really believed that I was the one to blame for the bullying. I hated myself. I also blamed my parents for my existence. At the time, I was about 15 years old. I made a mistake not talking to someone about being bullied, but then I changed schools, and things changed for the better. Before this episode, I had a happy childhood. My parents understand me a lot. We talk, but they can't help me with certain things, especially finding friends and a job. I would like to have a female friend, someone who will be there when my parents are not around. This is one of my biggest fears, opening the door of my house and having no name to call, or having nobody to know that I woke up or went to sleep, cooked, or that I am sick. I want somebody with whom to share my leisure time with. I don't know what will happen to me in the future, but I'm afraid of growing older because my chances of finding a partner and even a job is growing smaller the older I get. We don't have to get married, but maybe we can look after each other. I don't like being alone, and it makes me feel sad and down. That's why I want a companion, so that I can talk to somebody. I want to cry, but I keep my emotions locked inside. I get angry at myself because I think there is something wrong with me. I don't know exactly what it is or what I am doing wrong. I have made friends in this group before, but they leave the group and I don't see them again. I know I lack social skills. I don't know how to relate to other people. I want to learn, and DTC offers courses for social skills, but they are for disabled people, and I don't want to join them. I am not disabled. I want to change my situation, but don't know what I can do. This group helps me, and volunteers are very good. You cannot understand my situation. The group leaders encourage us to hang out with people. It does not mean that being with people does not make one lonely. I once went to Gozo with a few people. I was looking forward. It was my first time to go to Gozo with my friends. Things were quite different than I expected. I was with people yet felt alone. I wanted to feel part of the group, and I tried to go along with them, yet I felt like just a number. I felt frustrated, and I longed to be part of them. I was jealous of the others who seemed to be enjoying themselves. I found myself longing to retire to my own bed, the only place where I felt safe. I wanted to stay alone, listen to music such as Fade to Black. Interview to an abrupt end, and John asked me about the rest of the group. One volunteer told him they were waiting outside for him. Sadly, when we exited the premises with John, they had already left. John mumbled goodbye, put his hands in his pockets, and began to study the ground again. Then he disappeared into the darkness alone.
Joseph. Thank you very much, first of all, to our students. I would like to give a small profile of Dan Goodley. I have known Professor Goodley in much harder times, as I was doing my thesis, and poor man, he had to endure it all with me. Dan, if I may shift to first name basis, is a recently appointed professor at the Manchester Metropolitan University in the UK. It's in Manchester, right? He loves partying and is a seasoned lead guitarist. His only shortcoming is that he's a Nottingham Forest football fan, which sounds as bad as me being a Birkirkar FC Ultra. He has a passion for social justice and solidarity and has been engaged with the disability community during these last years, where he has written widely and profusely. Dan is chair of psychology at Manchester Metropolitan University. His research engages with the areas of disability, learning disabilities, narrative research and advocacy. He is a psychology graduate, got his PhD in a sociology department, and has worked in the departments of psychology, sociology, social policy, and education. He is therefore a bit of an interdisciplinary nomad, as he likes to call himself. Main theoretical resources include post-structuralism, post-modernism, critical disability studies. He has adopted methodological approaches of ethnography, narrative, and participatory research. His analytical resources also include, he has held posts at the University of Sheffield, amongst others, and travels widely to teach and research. Having established this collaboration between our faculty and Professor Goodley, I hope it will be a beginning of a concerted relationship between our two faculties.
While my secretary is setting up, I'd like to thank Andrew and Marilyn and Elena and Lillian, amongst many others, for organising this and giving me the chance to bring my children over out of school to Malta. I've heard lots about it. And I have a small library in my house of books on Malta that Andy has given to me over the years. So it's nice to actually see that he wasn't lying, that he is as beautiful as he said. So what I'm going to do in this session is I'm going to throw a lot more questions at you, and I hope you can understand my very northern English accent. At the back? Slight confusion, not really. No. When I was listening to the previous sessions, a kind of number of issues came through for me about what is real in narrative research. So just to briefly remind you, maybe, or at least my take upon the sessions, Marilyn's session asked a number of questions around things like giving voice. And a question, of course, that comes through there is whose voice in narrative research? She mentioned carrying out narrative inquiry with respect. And that would obviously be respecting the people you're working with, but maybe respecting a particular cause. She also, I thought was a really nice term, talked about the process of befriending people in narrative inquiry, and that's something I hope to talk about a little more. And I really love that quote from Sartre, because as we know, he was French and massively into LSD, which is obviously the criteria for good theorists these days, which was, they all take LSD, is that all tales are untrue. And I love that idea. So there's something untrue to storytelling, and perhaps we can actually look at what that means. The session just before from the MA students, I mean, I was struck straight away with the power of storytelling there. Yeah, the storytelling has a very powerful impact. Stories are very troubling. And when you read one of your own stories, you can often feel very embarrassed by doing so, because you're not quite sure what people will do with your story. So the whole kind of impact around audience, I think, is a big point. And I just want to say, for the last session particularly, that I thought it was a very courageous session, particularly because you're a very strong and in some case very brutal story out into public. And that session also picked up upon notions of loneliness and vulnerability, which I think come through a lot in narrative inquiry. And two other things that occurred to me in the last session. One was around the relationships between professionals and vulnerable people, and how tricky that can be, but also about the gains of group membership, that stories are never told alone, they're told together. On the other two sessions, by the way, I'm going to talk about other things and not just recap, but I think these are important. Simone's session came out with some nice phrases too. One was about the idea of stories providing a public space for the articulation of injustice. And that's something I think is a key aspect of narrative inquiry. Well, she also spoke about the need to deconstruct otherness, and deconstruct is a word that she's used a lot in research, and perhaps we can look at that. And finally, Andrew's session pointed to a number of problematics, really, with the narrative inquiry. And two kind of struck me, and hopefully something I could talk about now. One is around the idea that narrative inquiry can be a liberating methodology, but in doing so, it actually engages with something called the human subject. And we know the trouble with the human subjects is they've often been constructed by other subjects for a variety of means. And as somebody who works in a psychology department, I'm surrounded by colleagues who are obsessed with understanding and therefore constructing particular subjects. And they're not the kind of people you want to be locked in a lift with, let me tell you. And the kind of final thing that came out through Andrew's session was the notion that in narrative inquiry, narrative researchers distort data and they manipulate. So the question is, can we trust these buggers? Might be something to ask about narrative researchers, and hopefully we'll come to that. That's where I'm from, Manchester Met. It's the University for the Industrial Working Class in Manchester. Okay, the resources, the main one is a plug for my book that I did with Rebecca Lawtham, who's also here with my children, and Peter Clough, not related to Brian Clough. Does anyone know Brian Clough? How dare you? He was an ex-manager of Nottingham Forest. It's pathetic, I know. And Michelle Moore, who's not related to that guy who does all that kind of stuff around how bad America is. I think that's more, anyway. Okay, so I'll be talking through that a bit. I've got a number of questions. These are posed in the actual the bump that you've got. And I hope these questions are of use to you, mostly, and less of use to me. First, I want to ask, to what extent can researchers draw upon their previous experiences? Too often research is something that we plan to do. But to what extent can research be a reflection on something we have done? So why is empirical research often positioned as something that's there to be planned? Why do we look at it as something we have already got? We've got a huge, if you like, collection of research stories from our own personal and professional lives. And that seems to me to be a key part of narrative inquiry. But of course, that then raises questions about how you can go about reviewing your own professional stories, how you make sense of these rich empirical resources, and of course, what counts as data. Data. Slobo Dan Milosevic. How do we reflexively account for the data that we choose to use? And what criteria do we use to assess this? So basically, I want to kind of throw lots of questions at you, but with the proviso that narrative inquiry is something that we all do anyway, so why don't we just do more of it, but do it for particular reasons? Okay, so let me just give you a brief kind of overview of some of the aims I've had in carrying out narrative inquiry. And when you write down your own aims, they sound very, very grand. Very grand. And if my mother was here now, oh, she'd be so proud. She would. If she wasn't in prison. Which is not true. Always interesting just to check an audience out with that one. I'll later tell you the Tourette syndrome pianist gag, and we'll see how we get with that. So my starting aim really is that I've got a long history of working with disabled friends and family members, and disability is a big issue for me, and the way in which people who are different and have impairments are perceived and treated is always something that's really, really pissed me off throughout my life from a very early age. And so really that's how I kind of got into it. And I initially got into psychology because I thought it would have all the answers. But as we know, if psychology's got all the answers, then they must be pretty stupid questions. Might be one way of looking at it. But basically the kind of aim there is to try and uncover, to make sense of, and most importantly challenge some of the conditions of exclusion that are experienced by people with impairments. And in education, obviously, we're thinking perhaps sometimes often about learners. So here, it's about promoting a socially sensitive agenda in relation to disability. And alongside that, like Andrew, it's about engaging with issues around inclusion. So the inclusion, particularly the inclusion of those people who are most difficult to include. I mean, that's kind of really where inclusion should be. And we're not just talking about education there. Inclusion, of course, brings into bear all aspects of society. And to make sense of exclusion and resistance. So these are kind of some of my aims and why I was going about using narrative inquiry. And until I came to Manchester, I was working in an inclusive education context. And that was really helpful and really useful. But it seemed to me that inclusion was far more than education, hence my reason to go back to psychology, where I think lots gets done in psychology that is particularly damaging to people. I do like aspects of psychology as well. I'll talk about those in a bit, maybe. Now, obviously, in searching for kind of finding a foundation, if you like, for some of these kind of aims, requires that we find a paradigm or a paradigm, which I prefer. And the paradigm I'm going to be talking about is one that's associated with disability studies. And disability studies is an emerging discipline of the last 20 years that is best to view like you would view feminism's critical race theory, post-colonial writing, queer theory, emergent minority writings. And disability studies primarily came from disabled people. So it is a paradigm that's linked in and located in the exclusion that disabled people felt and their attempts to challenge it. And, of course, in order to challenge things, we need to have some starting points. And these might be seen broadly as epistemological, foundational, philosophical. And here are some of them. Firstly, disability is a social, political phenomenon. We saw that with loneliness, just. Loneliness is not about a psychological illness. Loneliness is about relationships, it's about society, and it's about one's relationship with a community. The thing is, for disabled people and disabled children, education is implicated in the very construction of disability. You know, years ago in the UK, we used to talk about naughty boys, and now we talk about them as having attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You know, years ago, you used to get angry in the car, now it's road rage. But apparently there's something, I won't go there. Clearly we have something around the way in which institutions like education respond to and by definition construct aspects of disability. So in this sense, education has the power to include, but it also has the tendency to exclude. And educational professionals, just to pick on one, of which I'd include myself here, participate in these constructions. So educational professionals are part of exclusion and part of inclusion. And so finally, maybe along these kind of, within this paradigm, in setting out the problem, there's also this appeal that education should promote alternative visions and practices in relation to disability. So this is a kind of some of the starting points of my narrative inquiry. Here's a nice overview. This is Mike Oliver, who is, John Lennon and Mike Oliver are kind of been quite crucial in my life for very sad reasons, most of them involving activities alone in my bedroom. That's guitar playing and writing. And Mike Oliver was the first professor of disability studies. He's a disabled scholar himself. And he was the first to coin the phrase, the social model. And the social model of disability, I'm sure you all know this, is basically shifting the hegemony, as Marilyn was talking about earlier. Shifting the hegemony away from a view of disabled people as tragic, as disabled by their bodies, in need of medicalization, that then leads to professional dominance and the expertise of non-disabled people over disabled people, and it shifts the attention over towards a social model where we are all implicated. We are all individually and collectively responsible. And this is exciting because disability is not simply the remit of the medical model, it's the remit of anyone involved in youth, community, social work, sociology, philosophy, and so on. And here the social model is positing a different viewpoint. Some people have talked about this as a leap of faith, of moving away from constantly viewing disabled people in terms of their impairments and viewing disabled people in terms of the community and the social world. I'll give you an example. My mother-in-law, it's like those 1970s comedians. My mother-in-law. Somebody take her, please. My mother-in-law used to be a headmistress of a special school until she also ended up in prison with my mother. I'm going to go with that one now. That will be a trope that continues throughout this presentation. She was head of a special school, and I went along. It was in the early throes of my relationship with her daughter, not with her, because that would be wrong. And She said, you must come down, and you must come along to this special school Christmas pantomime. Yes, mother-in-law, I said. The first of many times I've said that. And each year it goes down to a yes, mother-in-law. And so I went down to the special school, and a variety of children, like any school, it's Christmas, there was a performance, and kids came up and did juggling and various things. And this guy came on stage, and I'll call him Hugh, which is a very good Welsh name. It was in Wales. And he did a fantastic version of Tom Jones, It's Not Unusual, in a black shirt, kind of, which is buttered down to here, with a medallion on. His mother, amazingly, had managed to source some leather jeans to fit him, you know, 7-year-old, still looking now, and he had those on. And what was particularly impressive about him was he was a great singer, he was a great mover, and he did it to the worst piano accompaniment of my mother-in-law. So what you had effectively, I could see, was just a pretty sparky kid who was like, you know, just good at singing or enjoyed singing. And as we were all applauding him, the special school teacher who was sat next to me said, It's amazing, isn't it, Lev? That's Welsh, by the way. A Welsh accent. It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing what he's done. And I said, yeah, he's really good. He's a really good performer. She said, yes, it's his syndrome, you know. And I said, what do you mean? It's his syndrome that makes him able to do that. Which has explained a problem I've had for a number of years. Because many a time when I'm walking down a high street in the UK, women throw knickers at me. Because I too have the Tom Jones syndrome. What do we have there? We have an example of viewing this poor lad. He can't even do something good without it being understood in terms of the individual model. Yeah? So all Down syndrome people are really happy, you know. And these kind of assumptions, like this one about Hugh, pervade society. And they link it to something very serious. And that serious point is that the discourse around disability tends to be one of individualising, pathologising, medicalising and excluding disabled people. And it is not simply about including disabled people in schools, it's actually about changing that discourse. And as we know, discourses are really, really difficult to challenge because they have words, and words have always been in other people's mouths, and words have a history to them. So we're talking, I think, about something important here. And it's about shifting the attention of people like that school teacher. Another little story, a friend of mine, Rob Evans, has the label of Tourette syndrome, and he wrote his PhD on Tourette syndrome, and he did this beautiful piece of work where he contrasted the dominant way of viewing Tourette syndrome, which is the medical model. You are what you are, you know, swearing, involuntary movements, noises, and it's a pathology, with different ways of viewing Tourette syndrome. I'll give you two examples from his work. One, he says, is that the best way to think about Tourette syndrome people is that they are like social cement. I was thinking, why do you mean? He said, well, watch this. And we're waiting for a train coming out of Bolton to Manchester. And we got onto the train, and Mr. T, as he calls it, kicked off. So he called someone a bastard or made a noise. And he said, watch those two over there. And these two complete strangers started talking to each other about him. He said, it's amazing, what a skill. I have this ability to get strangers talking. He said, now, what's interesting, when he was in India once, he was, I love this story. He said, I remember that time when I was going to visit my drumming teacher in India, like you do. And he said, he was on this train, and Mr. T kicked in. And this guy immediately came over, this Indian guy, and said, why are you doing that? Which he loves. Rob loves that. He said, you know, people approach me, let's talk about this. And he explained that in the Western world, there's this thing called Tourette syndrome. And the guy listened to this for a bit, and he said, no, that's absolute nonsense. You have a spiritual energy. And you know, you can imagine why Rob spends a lot of time now in India. Yeah? Because what we have here is the medicalization of lies are pervading, particularly Western contexts. Okay, we just have to look for, if we look a bit further then, around the social model, before we go into some storytelling, what do we understand around some of the labels that we use? I'm going to be referring to the work that I've done with people with the label of learning difficulties or learning disabilities. And I have a long kind of history of working with people, what used to be called mental handicap, working with people with that label. And if you ask, if you kind of go to the the dominant hegemonic literature, you'll get definitions of disability, which are very medicalizing. But if you go to the social scientific literature, or you speak to people themselves, they come out with quite complex understandings of disability. Dingham, it's meant to be 1968, not the year 168, which would be a bit of a find, wouldn't it? Says, what should concern us is a mystifying fact that so many social scientists do not regard mental retardation, that's what it's called then, as a social and cultural phenomenon. And I say mystifying because nothing in the probabilistic world of social scientific reality is more certain than the assertion that mental retardation is a socio-cultural problem through and through. This was in 1968, and it's almost like, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s onwards, this, rather than going down that route, there was this proliferation of the psychologization and the medicalization of learning disabilities, so that Hugh can't sing anymore without it being a syndrome. The third one is a great one. This is Larry. He was asked what learning difficulties means or what mental handicap means. He says it means no one will hire me on a job unless they hear from a rehab counsellor or social worker. Get what I mean when I say it's hard for handicapped people to find a job. That's how he defined a mental handicap in relation to the power that it gives others over you. Okay, I won't go through all this. The top one, I love this one. Martin Levine was asked about what is mental handicap. He said, well, if someone else whispers a lot during the play, people might ignore it or get angry. If we whisper, it's because we're retarded. It's like we have to be more normal than normal people. That's a very serious issue, particularly in the UK at the moment, because the growth in numbers of adults with mental handicap or parents with mental handicap has really posed a lot of issues to social work teams. And a study carried out by Tim and Wendy Booth on parents with mental handicap, they actually looked through social work files about the assessment criteria. And essentially, it's assessment criteria is if they meet this criteria, they could keep the child. And most parents with mental handicap don't keep their kids. And Tim and Wendy Booth concluded that if you applied the criteria of good parenting skills to anyone else in the population, none of us would have any kids in our houses. They'd all be in care. So there's something quite weird about being disabled. There's an expectation of being, you know, pathological, but there's also an expectation that if you are going to succeed in the community, my God, you're going to have to try hard. Okay, so a way out of this, then, in terms of the social model, is to separate things. It's to start thinking about a position. And links back to the notion of positionality that was mentioned earlier. And this is something that I play around with. It's a very useful starting point for me. I do have problems with it, but firstly, we have impairments. You know, you can't use your legs, so you're in a wheelchair. You can't see. You're the definition of a blind person. No one's denying embodiment or the body. But the crucial issue for us, according to this paradigm, is disability. And disability is the exclusion of people with impairments from wider society. I hope that makes sense. So that's just a very kind of brief overview of kind of where I come from. Right, so I want to just go specifically now into a little study which is around narrative research and tease out a few things around it, which come from this kind of paradigm. I'm referring to a research project, and this is a research project which actually wasn't really a research project. This research project is 15 years of knocking around, doing ethnography with people with the label of learning disabilities. And it occurred to me that I was kind of carrying out loads of research and doing various things, but I never was writing about the stuff that I was doing at least twice a week. So I was not kind of thinking about how that might be a useful resource. And of course, this is what practitioners do a lot. Social workers and teachers are the worst. They sit on lifetime's worth of stories, of data, of good practice and bad practice. And they never get the chance to write about that and document that. And interestingly, alongside this is this huge industry of researchers, often novices, who know nothing about those contexts but kind of, you know, get their funding and arrive and go, hello, right, I've come here to render that strange thing familiar. And it seems that that's a strange situation we have around the research industry. So I wanted to kind of address that, really. And in order to do this, you have to come up with, obviously, a research question or a research aim. So here it is. People with learning difficulties or learning disabilities are increasingly being educated and trained. So more and more people are being educated. There are more and more people in the community. But questions remain about whether or not the opportunities they are given are empowering or disabling. And here are some specific research questions there. What can one life story tell us about the social and cultural worlds inhabited by people with learning difficulties? So what can a story tell us about that? To what extent can one story, only one, illuminate all these other big things, policy, practice, meaning-making, discourse? And thirdly, what questions are raised about the use of these methods in research? Okay, I want to introduce, those are my questions, I want to throw them back to you. Think about how you are interrogating your own meaning-making and policy and practice. How prominent is your voice in this process? Are you taking your stories seriously? Do you actually document your stories in your own lives? Do any characters spring to mind? And where are things like society, culture, and resistance in your analyses? So I'm hoping the kind of questions I was posing have more general and more significant questions for you. Okay, so what I'm going to do is briefly to read you through a life story. I think it's in the seminar packs. On a beautiful lilac colour. Beautiful lilac colour. Ah, that's a shame. Apparently some of you got the white ones. If you'd like to complain about that, right, the complaints forms are in seminar pack. Okay, so I'm just going to read through, I'm not going to read through it all, I'm just going to read through some of those bits, but as way of you not losing track because of my dreadful Northern English accent. Okay, so this is a story, and the person this story is about is a guy called Jerry O'Toole. And the story is called A Design for Life, which is basically a rip-off of a Manic Street Preachers song. Anyone who knows that, because I'm down with the kids. Okay then, let me just read you a little bit out of it, and then we'll come back to what this story could tell us. So the first bit, here are some of my precious stories, events that shaped me. You won't have heard of them, it's time to start listening to what we have to say. Sooner or later, you'll listen. You'll have to. It's difficult to explain to you about places you may never have experienced. You've seen people like me, though, in shopping malls, in fast food restaurants, in minibuses with steamed-up windows, in small groups shadowed by senior, more competent adults, middle-aged women or young, trendy blokes with goatee beards. And our cultures sometimes cross swords. You have words for people like me, retard, defective, idiot, spaz, monk. You may not use these words now, but if pressed, you would shamefully recall a childhood vocabulary that flourished with such insults. I'm going to move down the page. I'm a resident. You reside. I'm admitted. You move in. I'm aggressive. You're just assertive. I have behaviour problems. You are rude. I'm non-compliant. You don't like being told what to do. When I ask you out for dinner, it's an outing. When you ask someone out, it's a date. I don't know how many people have read the progress notes people write about me. I don't even know what is in there, but you didn't speak to your best friend for a month after they read your journal. I made mistakes during my cheque writing program, and someday I might get a bank account. You forgot to record some withdrawals from your account, and the bank called to remind you. I wanted to talk with a nice-looking person behind us at the grocery store. I was told that it was inappropriate to talk to strangers. You met your spouse in the produce department. They couldn't find the bean sprouts. I celebrated my birthday yesterday with five other residents and two staff members. I hope my family sends a card. Your family threw a surprise party. Your brother couldn't make it from out of state and it sounded wonderful. My case manager sends a report every month to my guardian. It says everything I did wrong and some things I did right, but you're still mad at your sister for telling your mum after you got the speeding ticket. After I do my budget program tonight, I might go to McDonald's if I have enough money. You were glad the new French restaurant took your charge card. My case manager, psychologist, occupational therapist, nutritionist and house staff set goals for me for the next year, but you haven't decided what you want out of life. Someday I will be discharged, maybe you will move onward and upward. That's actually a story of, really, from Jerry about Jerry's friends. Not really about Jerry. What do you feel when you see us, when you see that guy in the street? Is it pity, sadness or a sense of fortune? Well, you might be writing down those feelings of concern, but the reason you feel like you do is less to do with my condition and more down to the world that creates me in its own vision. In spite of, or because of, these difficulties we have in related to one another, people like me, my comrades and I, we've been quietly getting on with changing things. You just never knew anything about my story and all the others that come from this new burgeoning, exciting, radical movement called People First. People First, by the way, is a self-advocacy organisation of people with learning disabilities. Second paragraph down, my father was a tall, strong, vocal man. He smoked woodbines, that might be lost on you, and loved a pint in the local working men's club. He was funny and imposing, and when I was 18, he took me and my older brothers to the club to celebrate. And I am now a paid-up card-carrying member. The Friday after my dad died, I went in. And at the bar, Clive, the secretary, tells me that I need to pay for my own membership. You're a member in your own right now, Jerry. Now your dad is gone, God rest his soul. You can't be his guest, you need to be a proper member. I asked him how much it was. 85 to you? £85, I thought. Can I pay in instalments like my mum does with a washing machine? 85 pence, you daft bugger, laughed Clive. They often get me like that. Somehow there was always someone around. If my mum and dad were at work, then there was always an older sister there to make my tea, run my bath, tickle me. Every morning when I was young, my dad walked me to the school. We would stop at the dual carriageway across from the special school and watch as my schoolmates were ferried past in ambulances. When they finally arrived at school, they were travel sick from the rough journey. Jeremy would make me laugh, telling me how they'd hang onto the stretcher that was kept between the rows of seats. Of course, when they were around a corner, the stretcher would move and they'd be pulled to the back of the bus, scattering those that stood up, kids flying into one another. Once in school, things were never so bad for me. I have friends now who have never had a family safe haven. Sophie's mother couldn't cope. Sophie was ordered off to hospital when she was young. She never said much about her time there, but I know from others that she was made to wear weighted boots in institutions and they used to drug and hit her. On to the next page, the last bit I want to take. I was in and out of special schools and eventually left at 15. And they were strange places, funny buildings. You were labelled as soon as you got there. Lessons were boring, colouring in books that were already covered with the crayon scribbles of previous year's students. Class after class with the headmaster playing piano, asking us which piece of classical music he was murdering. Key and lively young teachers joining us straight from teacher training college, only to promptly leave by the end of their first or second term. Broken people. Students sound asleep in class, drooling onto the desk where they rested their heads. My mother would complain. Why can't Jerry be taught proper maths and English, she would tell the teachers. They told her I was struggling so much that I wouldn't be able to do the things my brothers and sisters were doing. Daft, really, because when I worked with my dad on the markets, I was really good at counting up the change people needed. One teacher said to my mother that I would never be able to read and write. I did, though, at home. It wasn't the best of places. One day, I broke into the caretaker's office. I nicked a spade. And sometime later, the teachers caught me trying to dig myself out of the school. I was trying to escape under the fence. I got into trouble a lot at school for talking or having a laugh in class. And the school was eventually burnt down by some big lads off the estate. Okay, I'm going to leave that there, and please read it in your own time if, like me, you lack a social life. Now, that is a story. That's one story of Jerry O'Toole, which is, I hoped, would answer some of these questions, or all of these questions. What can one story tell us about the social and cultural worlds? To what extent does the story illuminate policy, practice, and other things? And what questions and methods are raised about the use of narrative methods in educational research? Okay. Now, I was really struck by something Marion said about stories and truth. And I love the wash powder box truth. It just works. I'm now going to tell you some things that sometimes lead people to hate me. But please don't. Bear with me. I want to tell you how the story was written. The story is absolute fiction, in the best sense of that word. Jerry does not exist as a real person, but he does. Jerry is what we might call in narrative research a composite story. A collection of people, but not one. And the stories told there are from 15 years of stories that I collected in knocking around with people. Now, Jerry, if he is anybody, or parts of the story, if they are about anybody, they're about one particular person I'm thinking of, who's a friend of mine, Kadam, who I asked to write the story with, and he was not interested. He said, why would I want to do that? I said, well, why don't we write this story together? You know, we could get it out. Why? And I've tried for about 4 years to try and get him to write this story, and he always said no. So eventually he said, well, I'm not really interested. Your job sounds a bit dull. I was struck by that when you read that biography. How dull am I? Some interesting issues around power. But I still think lots of his stories, which do permeate this story, were very important. I said, well, can I write about some of the things you've told me? And he said, yes. I said, do you want me to read them or check them? He said, no, I'm not interested. So Jerry is, at times, some kind of resemblance to one person. Particularly when Jerry, as a story, if you do get a chance to read it, is very unlike people, many people with learning difficulties. And that, by that I mean the stereotypical view of people with learning difficulties. He's articulate. He has a job. He goes to the pub on his own. He has, he almost has this kind of alternative curriculum that went on at school, at home, compared with school. And in this sense, Jerry's quite an interesting story. His life appears to say something to me about existing differently to some of his welfare-located peers. In the story, many of the italicized sections are stories of other people with learning difficulties who he might be seen to occupy more disabled places. But he also seems, his story also seems to contrast with the view of disabled people as strangers, because he was out there doing stuff. Crucially, this story, I think, says some dramatic things about the educational, training and community cultures that he and other people with learning difficulties occupy. So how has he written? He comes from a variety of sources. He comes from research field notes from funded projects. He comes from direct quotes from secondary sources. The I'm a Resident You Reside is a poem by Elaine Popovich, which is referenced within the text. Some of the stories within Jerry's story come from a number of individual, quite formal individual and group interviews I carried out with people with learning difficulties. But most importantly, I think, lots of the stories here are what might be called personal gems, anecdotes that have been with me for a long, long time that I just wanted to get down, which says a lot about the way in which people with learning difficulties were being treated. They're also very troubling extracts from my own life that I never want to read out in public, but I felt I could actually include them here. They're also, crucially, within that story, documents produced by people with learning difficulties, people with learning disabilities' own words. And they're also narratives from other publications that I've been involved in. Two more. There's some really lovely kind of literature within the social model and disability studies that I wanted to convey. There's a great, the line which is, you know, the reason you feel like you do is less to do with my condition or label, which I read out, is actually a paraphrased definition of the social construction of impairment from Paul Abelly's paper. And Jerry's Irishness, his background, the brothers and sisters are completely made up. They are characterizations. There was no dad that died. There was no brothers and sisters that looked after, but except there was in Jerry. Now, this is all a bit troubling. And it led to once when I read out something from this in a conference, somebody actually said, I really can't say this because I do not trust you. And you may well feel that now. In fact, I'm sure people, many of you, all of you will. But let's have a look. Let's try and go with this notion of narrative. Because what came through in the early presentations was a playfulness, but also a commitment to storytelling, but also its consequences. I don't think we're here today to tell stories just for the sake of it, nor are we here to tell stories because we don't have some political or moral convictions. In fact, if anything, many people are drawn to narrative because of political convictions, because they give voice to people whose stories are never actually represented. That they give voice to a whole sections of society, migrants, who are not actually represented in the dominant worldview. But let me take you through some of the criticisms that I've received about this story. Firstly, it's fiction, and therefore it is not real data. So, going back to the aim of this whole seminar today, capturing the real It clearly is not doing that, would be one criticism. But as we know with most criticisms, there's always they're like your two-sided coins. We can come back on that one. I've been accused of being irresponsible. Someone once said to me, how dare you give me Jerry and then take him away? Which I thought was slightly melodramatic. But at the same time, I was quite pleased that it had that kind of impact. But people say, this is irresponsible. You're basically just making it up as you go along. So what happens then? You do a piece of research that you don't agree with, or you do a piece of research and you find something you don't agree with. Are you just going to fictionalise and lie and put in what the hell you want? I don't think people, particularly narrative research, make those decisions so lightly. An interesting criticism of the composite narrative was from an old friend of mine, actually an ex-friend of mine, that's an interesting story, who suggested, clearly wrongly, that the composite does away with the potency of narrative research, which was we talked through about a couple of times, was the notion that it allows for an engagement with the individual aspects of life as well as the more general. And as soon as you write a composite, that is, you get loads of stories and put them into one person, it's like a statistical mean. I'd quite accept that as a criticism. But, you know, let's be honest, time is short these days. We often only have time for reading one story. Could be a simple, practical response to that. Another criticism is this kind of composite narrative storytelling homogenises people. It says everybody's like Jerry. I think that kind of ignores the complexity of stories, really. The other two are criticisms that I would accept. There's a certain voyeuristic tendency to this storytelling. I have to say that anyone who's interested in listening to stories is a bit of a voyeur anyway. You know, you need to analyse that one and go to therapy. But there's something voyeuristic about listening to, probing out particular stories. There's an interesting one that we often are only interested in the exotic stories. The stories that are troubling, that are difficult. Would we write stories about the mundane? I think we do. I think they're called soap operas. And they're great. So I think we do that. So, okay, it's an issue, but I think we could change that. The other criticism is that it's top down. The voice, going back to Marion's point, the voice here is very strongly mine. It is my voice. But at the same time, I think that is far too simplistic. Let's look at some kind of the proponents then. The proponents of composite narratives, of this approach to narrative inquiry, will suggest that it's not about fiction and real and unreal. It's actually a process of metaxis, which is nicked from drama, which is the blurring of facts and fiction. The best fictional story is always very real. And if I were to kind of be touched by things, well, I have to be careful how I go with this. If I want to be touched by things, I often would go for things like songs and movies. Yeah, which are often very based around fiction, than I would the newspaper. So there's something there about emotion. I think there's a point was made there about the emotional aspects of storytelling. The other point around this is that there's nothing more real than a piece of fiction. There's nothing more real than telling a story. And I would suggest that Jerry's story is all real. It comes from whatever real we understand, but it's from very real sources. So fiction is real. And more than this, storytelling is about humanity. And in the storying of other people's stories, this might be part of a human endeavour. And finally, the most amusing stories are to be found in psychology or scientific papers, which say things like, a study was carried out. Where it's almost like a researcher, when they write up their research, have to get rid of the I. And it's almost like, I love it because it sounds like they haven't done the research. It sounds like they were walking down the corridor and they saw, they opened the door and wrote, a study was carried out. So it's kind of like, you know, passing over of that, it's not really me. And here I think, because in the composite the I is so prominent, then that actually places a lot of responsibility on the researcher. Okay, so the method. It's my story. I was interested in persuading people. Based upon the idea of around experiences of people with learning difficulties, I think it's full of rich, real experiences. It is full of real people, though the way they can now come across is not so real. And it challenges something which abounds within Western society. And this might be a nice philosophical point to move on to a consideration of postmodernism. One of the recurring themes within research involving people with learning difficulties or vulnerable people is the question, are we really getting to the authentic understanding of people's lives? One of the criticisms I've had about research I've done with people with learning difficulties is that, yeah, okay, but you're only really talking to the articulate people. You're not really talking to the real people with learning difficulties out there. And if you, when I probe people about that criticism, what they mean is people who lack articulation. Now, I think that narrative inquiry goes down into a cul-de-sac if it starts worrying about, or over-worrying about, whether or not we can get to the real. It goes back to Marion's point earlier about, do we really care about truth? Aren't we more interested in the kind of persuasive aspects of a story? And the truth is that for many of us in society, we are expected to embody what might be called a unitary humanistic subject. That is, a bounded human being who is rational, can work, can do well at school, can pay taxes, can vote, can engage in an objective manner. And the truth is that increasingly, through the kind of disciplinary practice of things like therapy, we are all expecting ourselves to constantly be the unitary humanistic subject. It's also known as the Oprah Winfrey style of society, or the therapeutic condition that we're now in. Okay, and I'm going to say a couple of more things, really, about the method and the aims of that, and how it might link in with some thinking about analysis. I'm going to suggest that Jerry's story is a post-structuralist tale. I'm going to suggest that Jerry is the Michel Foucault of his time. I'm going to suggest that Jerry allows us an opportunity for engaging with some quite exciting other ways of thinking around disability. So what is this post-structuralism then? What is postmodernism? In 2 minutes. Postmodernism might be understood as, a friend of mine coined it quite nicely, postmodernism is where small groups are more important than society, where individuals are more important than small groups, and where shopping is more important than everything. So postmodernism is something around this kind of opening up of choice and consumption. But at the same time, postmodernism says some very serious, and I would suggest very productive things to the world of narrative inquiry and to disability studies. Post-structuralism might be understood as the methodology of postmodernism. But of course, as all post-structuralists say, as soon as you define it, then you're not being post-structuralist anymore. And so the academic careers continue. And the cyclical arguments continue. Let me just pick up on what it is then. Postmodernism has been criticised. Postmodernism is seen as being defeatist. Postmodernists are seen as giving up on the modernist agenda of progress, of science, of socialism, of truth, of emancipation. Assiter is a real critic of postmodern thinking and suggests that all postmodernists are middle-class academics just trying to find yet another way of articulating a viewpoint that bears no resemblance to the real world. And that's why we shot her, which is clearly wrong. Postmodernism, in a more positive frame of thinking, might be considered to be a radical political departure that might have some positive aspects for us as storytellers. If you want to know about postmodernism, I would suggest, and you don't know already, is to look at the work of Lyotard, whose book, In the Postmodern Condition, says that postmodern thinking is an attitude or a response, particularly to modernity's grand narratives. So this, with the truth thing's coming back here. And for disability, one of the biggest grand narratives around disabled people is the medical model. Is the individual model, is the notion that you are what you are because of your body not working properly. And so it seems to me that embracing postmodernism actually might be pretty fruitful. Lyotard suggests that postmodern thinking then is about three things. It's about challenging grand narratives in three ways. Challenging the way that they're constantly overarching and we can explain everything. Challenging the ways in which modern discourses are foundationless. And also challenging the way in which modernity is constantly interested in progression. Okay, what I'm going to do is just take a little aside and tell you another story. In a recent research project, we spoke to parents of disabled children. And we were particularly interested in parents whose disabled kids were, you know, from birth up to 4 or 5 years old. And we ended up speaking to about 54 families over 3 years, all of whom had a child who was disabled. And we spoke to them, and we spent time with them. We carried out ethnography over a 2-year period. And we got all the data back. And we were reminded of that great paper by Walker in 1981, who recalls interviewing 500 teachers and coming back into his office with them after 2 years, looking at the reams and reams of interviews and thinking, what have I done? We're in that very similar kind of situation. We basically had so much data information from parents. So in order to help us make sense of the data, we went away and we read around the literature that had already been written around parents of disabled children. And what came through were a number of things. I just want to talk about one. Within the literature around parents of disabled children, there's a certainty. Again, that was a word that cropped up earlier. There's a certainty about how we can understand those parents. So in the literature, you get labels like parents in denial. And these are parents who haven't yet got used to having a disabled child. Fighting parents, enabling parents, empowering parents, and more worrying, disabling parents. And the truth is, when we were reading this literature, we felt very uncomfortable about this. Primarily because we'd befriended lots of parents. We got all their data, all their stories around their lives, and it felt really uncomfortable to say, you know, sit down in an office space and I'd say, okay, so, you know, which one of these is disabling? Which one of these parents is in denial? Okay, and between me and you, we actually did do that for a couple of weeks. And we found that when we read through the stories of the parents we collected, they might be seen as disabling for about a minute in the interview, and then suddenly they say something empowering. And then they're quite certain about what's going to happen with their child, and then they start being all uncertain. And the complexity of people's lives is not captured in the certainty of the previous literature. And this, we would argue, touches upon the postmodern aspect of storytelling. Storytelling reminds us of the uncertain nature of lives. So when a parent says to us, I don't know what's going to happen with my child, I am coping, I take one day at a time, they're not in denial. They're not being, you know, lacking a kind of understanding of their child. Maybe they are just embracing more fluid, uncertain ways of the world. And in this sense, we could argue, this kind of storytelling is more like postmodern storytelling. Okay then, so back to Jerry. What is a post-structuralist tale then? A post-structuralist tale might be all of these things. Firstly, composite narratives are distributed. The subject is distributed. It is no longer bound upon one person, but it encompasses a whole variety of aspects of life. And increasingly, queer theorists have argued that if you are going to cope in this world, you have to be more and more distributed. You have to be more and more queer to cope with the structuring of life. So in this sense, maybe Jerry's story is more in fitting with the distributed nature of the way in which you live our lives. Jerry's story is a tale of many discourses and practices, we would suggest, within our book. When we go through those kind of aspects that I was reading there, we hear about particular policies around special schools. We hear about expectations around disabled children. But crucially, we also hear about resistance. And too often, stories about oppression and exclusion often make you feel like ending it all, really, because they are just so depressing around the way in which society can exclude. We would suggest then that in this sense, because it's multi-voiced and multi-layered, because the author and the subject are blurred, it allows us to try and make sense of opportunities for resistance. So here, discursive actions that are happening within the story are also plot lines. How do you go about analysing them, Jerry, if you're going to engage with this post-structuralist agenda? The answer is in discourse analysis. And discourse analysis might well be a way in which we could think a little more about why particular stories are there and why we use particular words. Discourse analysis is an approach that pays attention to the ways in which human beings are products of society, of societal ideas and practices. Berman and Park, for example, a couple of my colleagues in Manchester, talk about discourse analysis providing a social account of subjectivity. So ask not what is inside people's heads, but ask what is outside of their heads, and that is clearly society. Okay. I'm going to finish then with three very brief points then around Jerry's story and would kind of throw it back to you. I think that Jerry's story as a post-structuralist tale tells us three things. Firstly, I think it shows us in a discursive analysis kind of way that education creates learning difficulties. That Jerry, when he's in the market working with his family, when he's at home, is Jerry. When he's in the school, he becomes a pupil with learning disabilities. And education, in order to function, relies upon the objects of its study and intervention. It also requires a particular subject. The subject in British primary education increasingly is more of a rational, thoughtful one. My 6-year-old, the other night, woke up at 3 in the morning worrying about her homework and her SATs at 6 years old. I mean, what kind of subject's being created there? So generally, children are, particular subjects are being constructed within education. But in relation to learning difficulties, there is a particular construction of learning disabilities which potentially is disabling. So if you're Hugh, you can only ever sing Tom Jones really well because of your syndrome, because you're an object. You are not a subject that has the volition and the creativity around you. Secondly, I think that Jerry's story points to the ways in which education regulates and governs. And this links into that lovely phrase from Foucault, where he says, yes, of course you are free, but you are only free to govern yourself. So this notion that education creates and plants almost a governmentality or a form of government in somebody's head, a child's head. And for disabled children, this is increased. They are assessed, they are statemented, they are expected to behave in particular ways. If you're a disabled kid and you're included in a school, you often have an adult support worker with you all the time. And which led to, there's a guy called Richard Reeser, who's a very famous, in the UK, a very famous disabled activist and campaigner. And he's once said, I look forward to the day when disabled children are excluded from schools for being naughty. Because they have no chance, sadly, because they've always got some support worker next to them, supporting them. So even something as inclusive as having a support worker brings with it a governance, a regulation. And I would suggest that Jerry's story recognises this. And to finish then, in terms of the analysis of this story, and I think going back to the whole reason we're here, which is around storytelling, is that stories, because they are about the I, because they are about anecdotes, because they're about things that have happened to you in the past, they're always about things that you have done. The last story, for example, the last session, there were stories there of exclusion, but there are also stories of things that the person liked and the things that they are doing. And so this sense, I would suggest that stories allow us to recognise how we can resist and challenge dominant ideas that exist around us. And it could be suggested that there's nothing more resistant than trying to dig yourself out of a special school. Okay, to finish. I went off in a bit of a post-structuralist crazy moment then, to bring you back. We all have rich stories to draw upon. And maybe the time, if we're not doing it already, we should be just drawing upon these more and more in our own research. How we write those stories raises loads of epistemological positions, theoretical arguments, and so on. But let's not shy away from them. Let's write fiction, for example, or let's write with people. But let us always recognise that that comes with problems, but also, hopefully, good consequences. And obviously, we need to remain critical about the subjects and the objects that we create in our research. Perhaps really the one criticism that I would want to hear from people is whether or not I have done justice to the experiences of people with learning difficulties in Jerry's story. And if there was any sense, for example, that I was victimising or homogenising or, you know, othering yet again disabled people, which I think I do within that story, then that is a debate that I want to continue to have within when we're trying to capture the real in narrative inquiry. Thank you for your patience.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much, Dan. We wanted to dedicate some time for discussion. The idea is not for people necessarily asking questions. They may choose to draw something from what we said or criticize something from what we said, or else come up with some idea that they would like to share. So we have the roving mic, if I can ask Lillian, so that we can capture that on radio as well. If people are more comfortable, and I really mean this, people are more comfortable expressing themselves in Maltese, then we'll do the translation to Dan, because I am aware that maybe some people would prefer giving their comments in Maltese, so they would be more than welcome to do that. Any comments that people would like to share, or questions they would like to ask? The first one is always the most courageous, probably, to...
Hi, Dan. I don't know if you recognize me.
Of course.
Okay. I have to say this. Since day one, since I met Dan in Sheffield, he has started out saying, I hate psychologists. I am not a psychologist. And this speech is about the negativity of medicalizing and psychologizing. And... at first, it's just a comment. At first, it was a shock because I am a psychologist, by the way, for those who don't know me. And the reason I wanted to become a psychologist is to go against the kind of practices that you are against. I agree with you 100%. And I feel sometimes that the constructions that there are about psychologists, which are... they are founded on truth. There are... I'm trembling as I say this. I can't believe it. There are psychologists who do construct persons to their detriment. And there are psychologists who are not careful, who do not listen, and who deal with certainties. But there are also other persons, and in all the professions, who allow for contingency, who do deal with uncertainty, and who prefer this way of working. And I must say, I feel like a minority group when I speak to, when I listen to these kinds of lectures, and it's not just you. I actually mentioned you in my thesis because I was so angry about persons hating psychologists who are supposed to be there to help others. So... while I agree that the practice of helping others should not be done in such a way that it actually does not help, at the same time, let us be open to practices which are helpful in that they are open practices rather than closing ones. Thanks.
Well, I'm a psychologist too, as you know, so... I was being deliberately, mischievous, and that's because of the history in which psychologists fail to engage with disability studies, as you know, and that it's because if you say that, then you get a reaction. But I think I think it's less psychology is less the problem, more psychologization, which I think is a word, which is, and I think there's lots of very good critical psychologists who are really challenging that psychologization of life, where, you know, we're all. Well, okay, for people with learning difficulties and for vulnerable groups, that whole sense of becoming fully functioning and, you know, achieving competence, is almost thrown onto them, you know, not just by psychologists, but by the whole administrative and institutional practices. I mean, Nicholas Rose's stuff's like pretty good around that. And I think that that's the main problem. You know, what is it about the, what is it about that certainty which is associated with psychologisation, which ruins people's lives, you know? So I'd accept your point completely. And I'm sorry.
I'd like to sort of reiterate what Daniela and Dan are talking about, because I'm a psychologist as well, and at times I have difficulty identifying with that role, because I went on to do my doctorate in sociology, so I sort of hopefully see a bit. But I think I really could see a lot of what you were saying about disability studies. It's not my area at all. I'm more interested in addiction and criminality, and we see this happening all the time. People become addicts when they go to treatment. I mean, you know, then it is then that they start seeing themselves as, I'm an addict, I have a chronic relapsing condition. And it's probably a psychologist or a doctor, a social worker, who's persuaded them. And they're not fit for treatment till they, you know, internalize this definition. But I think psychology is opening up. I mean, there's a whole realm of narrative psychology, which is talking about all of these issues and talking about multi-voicedness and non-certainty. And so definitely, I think there's still hope for psychology in this regard.
Thank you, Lillian.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions. First of all, I totally agree with the whole perspective of narrative research. For example, I mean, I know and I believe that the shortest way between the truth itself and the heart of a person is the story. Example, I'm a sort of Tolkien fan, because I do believe that fiction represents the real. However, there were a couple of points. For example, regarding the self-interpretation of the person, there was something with the presentation of the master students, which you referred to as being the sort of problem, loneliness being the problem in relating with society. However, even through the presentation, one could conclude that, for example, a person who can be within a group can still feel lonely. Therefore, the problem would be more of sort of a relational problem with oneself rather than with the whole of society. As regards to also to the interpretation of oneself and the plurality of truths, on what are we basing the interpretation? For example, I'm through a situation and I interpret it myself. However, what's the basis for the interpretation?
I think it depends upon the way you approach the story. I think if you approach a story with an idea of the self as being fixed, and I think this came out really well in most of the presentations, then obviously you would ask that question. If on the other hand you see the self in a different light or from a different perspective, where the self is considered to be more fluid, more related to the context, and also open to the different interpretations that rise out of the of the different spaces and times in which that interpretation is done, then obviously you have a different you have an answer to that question, that there is no basis from which, no fixed basis from which you are interpreting that narrative. And that is the post-structuralist bit that Dan has explained so well, I think, in his presentation.
I mean, when that question becomes really, you know, difficult is in therapy, right? So let's take therapy as an example, and this is, you know, a form of psychology, not psychologization. But narrative therapy, which draws upon post-structuralist ideas and links it to the narrative psychology ideas, I think that's really interesting. I'm thinking about Ian Law's work, where he was working with a client. He's a counsellor using narrative therapy, and that client had eventually revealed that he'd raped somebody, right? So morally, politically, incredibly challenging, you know. And the question was, how do you interpret that in a way which is going to be helpful? Now, to whom? Well, to the person that was raped. to the person who's admitting to rape, to the relationship. And what was so interesting in that kind of therapeutic encounter is they talk about the constant storying and restoring and reinterpreting and the process of that towards particular goals. So I think your question is an interesting one. It would be about a notion of a consequence. You know, where are you aiming for? Rather than kind of, you know, what theoretical or political viewpoints are you drawing upon to make sense of it? And that story, again, I mean, I'm sure I showed that story from Ian around counselling that person. We would have very, very different views on it, because for some people it's just too troubling that he didn't actually say to the person, you did it, you take the responsibility. He was talking about externalising that behaviour, trying to look at like wider notions of masculine discourse. This is in therapy. Now, very troubling, but it seems to me that your question is one that has to be asked and re-asked every 5 minutes, you know, in the process of interpretation. And if we say, well, I think it's this, then we're struggling. Yeah.
It's turning into a family thing, careful.
Yeah. How did this story of Gary create you at the end of the day? I mean, because I'm just in this idea of self-creation. How did it create you as the writer of the story? If you can, can share some.
Well, I mean, we've spoken about this, but and I do mean this. I'm not very good at telling stories. I don't think I'm a particularly good storyteller. That's the first thing, and that is the biggest. We've kind of been around it today, but you know, when Plummer talks about, you know, you've got to give up, you know, good storytellers, you give up on all your social scientific training, and you start asking yourself what makes a good story. Now and. You know, let's be honest, if you go to Qualitative Inquiry as a journal, you'll find lots of really bad stories written by academics. You know, I was there reading through a paper drinking my coffee one morning when the head of faculty walked in and thinking, oh dear. So I think that's the first thing to bear in mind. How it constructed, I think I became, what's less comfortable about my storytelling. I think I became a bit more comfortable about my foundations through the storytelling. And really, one of those is I really don't think that learning disabilities exist. I think it's completely discursive. It's completely story. It's all about different stories. That things like medicalization are just lots of powerful stories. And in that sense, I think when I think of myself in relation to that, it made me more of a relativist, actually. So the actual process of writing that story made me give up on some of even the real bits like the body. So I think the writing story, one answer to that would be it helped me find a theoretical place that I feel more comfortable with. I don't know if that's answered the question, though.
I guess it does make you question sort of, you know, scientific canons and what is right and what is wrong and what is acceptable and unacceptable. I have in... My dissertation was about criminal careers, and I have spoken to people who, you know, told me I raped, and I've actually interviewed murderers as well. And you come to understand, it might seem a bit freaky, but you come to understand their point of view as well and how it happened. And I think perhaps the biggest difficulty is refraining from judgment, and because I do have a value system nonetheless, although I feel it has become somewhat wobbly along the way, because you know, it makes you reconsider, definitely. And perhaps in any context, I could be. I think the idea of fluid identities is really important. If you take us away from all our props, we could be.
To take up on Marilyn example, what makes me think is, what have I heard? The story of a murderer. And I am, you know, related to somebody who the murderer has murdered. I think I would find real difficulties in understanding or coming to the kind of understanding that you are talking about. So that is why I am questioning the idea of, and also making the point that it depends on the position you are taking when you are interpreting the story. Because, and I also to reflect on the problematic that I posed in what happens when somebody becomes indifferent to the story or just cannot empathize with the storyteller's position. What is the role of the narrative researcher then in confirming the political functions that I believe so much, you know, a narrative researcher should do, and we all agree that is, and I think it would take quite a life story to come to a conclusion, so, but I just wanted to, you know, reflect on what if I were the murderer, but what if I were the wife of somebody or the daughter of somebody who was murdered, then how do those positions create different knowledges and different interpretations to those stories?
Andrew, okay. I'm not sure if I understood correctly, but I think, is it correct that I understood that as a researcher, we identify with the oppressors or with the oppressed, sort of, that we identify with one or the other? I have a question about this in the sense that even the concepts in themselves have their own narrative. Sort of, I could be a researcher who wouldn't necessarily identify with the oppressed or with the oppressors, and even the terms in themselves already imply a story and need to be questioned.
So that's a very difficult one. I come probably from where I come from is from the disability studies field. So, and definitely there I need to take a very clear position. But now, as I'm hearing Marilyn and Simone talk, then, you know, you start questioning things as well, whether it's that easy to identify yourself or choose or take a clear position. I think something that we haven't done as researchers, if I had to sort of widen a bit the argument, what we haven't done enough as researchers is take responsibility. And probably that is what I am really looking at taking on responsibility rather than pretending that I have understood and yet I make part of what people are suffering of, or I'm contributing in some way or another to the suffering of that individual. But it's a very complex issue. I wouldn't be able to answer that.
I'm asking as well because I have in mind oppressors and oppressed can be seen also as victims and abusers, for example. But if I say, as a researcher, I'm going to identify myself with the victim, in a way it is an aspect of the person. So even by saying I'm identifying with the victim, I'm not doing justice to the person. Because it's as if I'm seeing the person as a victim when in reality it isn't the personality of that person. So I'm saying in a way would be perpetuating the dominant story.
Professor Goodley, in your paper, you refer to discourse analysis as the way that you found as the best way to approach the analysis of the narratives of the parents of disabled people. Some discourse analysts tend to negate the existence of a fixed self that can be reached through research that we can know, and they focus only on the situation, on how people produce themselves in a research situation. Now, it seems that the narrative approach takes a completely different approach to the self, because obviously you are talking about a self which exists and which comes out through research. And I'd like to know what your position is. To what extent do you think that a narrative is a production of a specific research situation? And to what extent is it a reflection of the real person?
Yes, that's very tricky. A way out of it, I think, is given by Rosie Braidotti, who is a feminist scholar who uses the work of Gilles Deleuze, another dead French person. And within that kind of, she talks about nomadic subjectivity. So that instead of thinking of ourselves as bounded in that kind of phenomenological narrative approach, you have a bounded self, we can actually embrace some aspects of the discursive which you're talking about, which is the environmental. So it's more kind of, so instead of eggs, it's spaghetti all over the place. But she goes further. It's not just spaghetti, but it's deserts, not desserts, deserts, where you will actually settle for a time around particular
subjects, you know, a mother. That's very strong. That's a very strong one that came through in the parents' research. Political activist might be another. But actually, it's more than multiple cells. It's about manoeuvring. That's why I really like the migrant idea. This kind of journeying around these particular, transient subjects or phenomenological things, and then moving onward. Now, that really appeals to me because in relation to people with mental handicap, because it seems to me the basis of their oppression and exclusion is a conception of them as being a static subject. That's why I get troubled when people say, but is this really people with learning difficulties you're speaking to? Because they really want them to dribble a lot and not say much. That's what they're doing, you know? Now, I love the idea of discursive ideas. And this recently I've kind of been reading around Braidotti's stuff, and it seems a way out of what you're describing, which is that people kind of travel and manoeuvre along particular places, settling now and again. And that's great. Suddenly, you don't have learning difficulties. You are a person that goes to day centre in the morning, someone who makes your mum a cup of tea, someone who's not allowed to make a cup of tea in the day centre because of the risk. You know, so it's that kind of travelling nomadic subjectivity, I think, is the way I read it, has been a kind of response to precisely your question. And I'm looking at somebody over there who might be able to brand Deleuze and things, a philosopher. But I don't know, I don't think that's an answer, but I found that really helpful.
We'll just have the last comment from Michael.
Okay. What I wish to add is about the conversation you had just a couple of minutes ago with one of the participants, where the discussion was about whether identifying with the oppressor or with the oppressed. Well, in my opinion, perhaps I may be wrong, I think that the viewpoint will depend, the message that you wish to deliver after. For example, if you want to conduct, for example, a study about a sort of visual impairment, you know, like do you want, for example, to see the viewpoints of the visually impaired people, or perhaps you want to see the viewpoint of the people other than visually impaired, I mean the way they see them. Or perhaps you may wish to see both of them, like how one interpret the other. I mean, probably it's the message that the author wishes to deliver. And that's why it's very important that the sort of writing, you know, is very interesting, because first of all, I see it like collecting, you know, information and interviewing many people and collecting all in one. One would be more objective than just writing your own views and perhaps, you know, which may be jaundiced, you know, but collecting from a wide area of people, I mean, whether from one side or the other, or perhaps both, it would lead to a more objective study and more objective writing, which may lead to which may lead directly or indirectly to even improvement in our society as well.
Yeah, I think it goes also back to the question, doesn't it, about interpretation and intention of interpretation, about, you know, what is the actual aim of storytelling. And I think also link back to that question around the prominence of the subject in narrative, but at the same time our interest in the discursive. You know, so that, I think, is a good point that links those together.
Okay, thank you very much. That is it. I hope you had a good and a good evening. I would like to take the opportunity to wish you and yours a fantastic and festive season, and why not, a nice and merited rest.
You have just listened to the second and final part of an international seminar organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies, entitled Captivating the Real in Narrative Research.